Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrne, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrne Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. When the combination of heat and humidity smothered my area during the first week of July, the resident quadrupeds and I took a cue from the resident wildlife and went to ground. We didn't disappear into our burrows, but we did seek out the coolest locations in the house. While the pets lay about like lounge lizards, I tackled the growing pile of must-read articles in my file. One was a conversation with anthropologist and psychologist Brian Haar that I highly recommend for anyone who works with dogs. In a nutshell, he and other academics who also study various aspects of animal behavior are taking a multi-species approach to learn more about the evolution in human psychology. Among the things Haar discusses is the possibility that dogs are a self-domesticated species. This is a concept I first encountered in dogs. A New Understanding of Canine Origin, Behavior, and Evolution, written by Raymond Coppinger and Lorna Coppinger. It pleased me that some in the academic human behavioral community were willing to consider this possibility. It made me smile because self-domestication has been accepted in cats for ages. But maybe cats aren't a human behavioral sciences kind of animal. Or maybe animal self-domestication was one of those concepts, like animal cognition, emotion, and play for the sheer fun of it, that those in the human-centered behavioral disciplines traditionally considered blasphemous. Whatever the reason, I'm glad Brian Haar and his like-minded group are willing to tackle the political as well as the scientific aspects of canine self-domestication. From my perspective, though, his work raised another question. Is domestication, and the neurophysiology that supports it, strictly a human-animal phenomenon? Or is it simply the human version of the kinds of relationships that have existed between animals of different species for millennia? My ethological background leads me to suspect the latter. Some of these animal-animal relationships are quite complex, and their secrets have taken scientists years to figure out. Consider one such relationship between ants and aphids that seems to fit the bill. In this case, certain members of certain ant and aphid species are drawn together because the ants need a food supply, honeydew, that the ants can't produce, but the aphids can. Honeydew is an energy-rich substance that the aphids secrete when they feed on certain plants. But while honeydew may be a waste product for the aphids, it's life for the ants. Consequently, members of these ant species take good care of their aphids. They protect their aphids from predators when the aphids feed. They bring the aphids into their nests at night. They milk the aphids' honeydew and store it for future use. In the morning, they escort their aphids back to their plant source. I'm the first to admit that I have an active imagination, but I see a lot of similarities between this process and the human process of tending and milking dairy cows. Unlike aphids, dogs can't provide us with a source of honeydew. However, in ancient times and still today, some dogs serve as highly effective early warning systems to keep humans, their livestock, and other property safe. They protect and herd sheep and cattle. They serve as barriers between human habitats and wild animals. This includes wild animals who might be rabid or carrying other diseases harmful to people. They help humans hunt for a range of animal and other food sources. They transport people and products. In exchange for this, the humans supply access to food, water, shelter, quality human care when needed, and sometimes companionship. When these most ancient dogs and people reproduced, they passed on the potential inherent in such relationships to their offspring, just like the ants and aphids passed theirs on. But what about pet dogs? In their book, the Coppingers refer to pet dogs as parasites. From a strictly physical perspective, they are. They use resources, including some that many humans living in impoverished environments must do without. In return, pet dogs do what? They don't clean house, do the laundry, or mow the lawn. Although some of them might save us in the process of saving themselves, most probably wouldn't put their lives on the line for us. But while pet dogs may not supply us with food or help with home maintenance, our dogs do supply many of us with emotional sustenance that we otherwise would lack. Granted, no place exists for recording such contributions on the typical cost-benefit analysis sheet. Still, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist and that it's not valuable. According to the U.S. Census data, such effects could benefit a lot of us. More than a quarter of the U.S. population lives alone. For some in this group, canine companionship, as well as the human companionship that directly or indirectly goes along with dog ownership, provides a valuable service. For others, feelings of security or of being loved are worth the canine maintenance costs. Others find canine companionship less emotionally or time costly than living with human companions. Concurrently, the number of young adults living in households without children has risen dramatically. In 1967, 46.7% of the 18 to 24-year-olds had children living with them. But by 2016, this percentage had dropped to 31.2%. Changes are even more dramatic among the 24 to 34-year-olds. During that same period, the percentage living with children dropped from 76% to 28.5%. This shift in human-human relationships is significant because, whether those in the 18 to 34 age group acknowledge it, higher parental hormones with their accompanying desire to parent do flow through their bodies at this time of life. And what better way to address any parenting aids these may elicit if kids aren't an option than adding a member of a species that co-evolved and domesticated with us for millennia? This results in a bad news, good news situation for dogs. A recent article in the New York Times entitled "The Secret Price of Pets" by Peter Haldeman sums this up. It describes all the products and services that people may impose on their dogs if they choose. Although those seeking to sell these products and services often present them as beneficial for the dog's well-being, I was hard-pressed to find anything that would suggest this. Unless, of course, you believe that if it makes the dog's owners happy, it automatically will make the dog happy too. But given the disconnect between these products and services and an understanding of normal canine health and behavior, I have to question that assumption. On the upside, this does indicate that even if those who purchase these products and services know little about their dog's physical and mental needs, at least some of them do want to please their pets. More good news is that there are people out there who can't afford these products who could provide insights on more natural and inexpensive ways to their dog's heart, if that's the dog owner's goal. But in all cases, it boils down to the costs versus benefits for any one particular person and their dog. If the dog gains sufficient physical and mental benefits from the relationship to compensate for wearing a funny costume or carrying fake testicles in his scrotum, then the relationship will work for human and dog alike. And although the genetic potential for this example of human-canine domestication may not be passed on by either human or canine, it's possible that members of both species could pass it on via social learning. Perhaps at dog parks, or cocktail parties, or at least via social media.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.